almost. Yeah.
So with your indulgence. I've been giving a very desultory fashion because we keep in doing other things, which is great. So a series of talks that I thought was going to be one talk, but it turns out this is the fifth one. And I think it's probably going to be the last one, I hope so, about a kind of archetypal narrative of a sort of a possible story in what happens to people in Zen. And this is kind of like the sequel. This is like, you know, okay, so that's the end of the story, so now what? I've sent around the first three talks to anybody who wants them. The fourth one I'll put up on Dropbox soon. And if anybody wants some of the older ones or either one of the new ones, that's fine. I'd be happy to, very delighted to send them to you. So anyway, the kind of basic archetypal narrative that we were looking at had something to do with that traditional sense of descending into darkness or nothingness or emptiness, and then that not at all being the end of the journey, but coming back out into the light or being rolled back out by the light. So it's a story of what's called opening or awakening or kensho or enlightenment in some way. We took our cue from a really old poem by the, I think it's 9th century Chinese teacher Shito Shichen, which in our tradition is called Taking Part in the Gathering. And I'll read just a tiny bit of it to remind us of where we were. So, the mysterious source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. Trying to control things is only delusion, but hanging onto the absolute isn't enlightenment either. We and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven, and this interweaving continues on and on while each thing stands in its own place. So I really do want to get to the sequel, but I'll just do, I've been watching a thing on Showtime, so this is like previously on Homeland, you know, that kind of things. So just the quickest possible thing, you know. So a couple of quotations that we associated with that sort of sinking down into darkness would include Hakuin saying the whole universe was sheer darkness, and Linji, the great Chinese teacher, saying it was like an ice cave a million miles thick. And then there's that really canonical story where the great Japanese teacher Hakuin, who says the whole universe was sheer darkness, when he's just kind of starting out and he's had a very deep experience like that, goes to his teacher and the teacher asks him about it and he says, oh, nothing whatsoever to take hold of. And the teacher grabs his nose and twists it really hard and says, I have no difficulty whatsoever taking hold of it. And then he sort of starts saying, oh, you monk in a dark cave, are you satisfied with that? Okay. So the tradition also talks about needing a place to turn around. And in a wonderful talk by Norman Fisher that we played about a year ago, one of his teachers, Katagiri Roshi, says, when you get to that dark place, you need to bounce. So that sense of sort of streaming back into the world of existent things with a different sense of them and a different sense of oneself. So we talked on the one hand about a profound sense of interpermeation. And I did just say one thing about that. I guess that one of the things that strikes me about it, that sense of being no different from the things that you're seeing on some fundamental level. In my experience, it has something of the quality of tautology. So instead of saying, oh, you're no different from it, isn't like saying water's cold, but it's like saying water's water. I don't know quite how else to convey it, but a sense that it's below anything that you could actually assert, that it's before that in some way. So there's that, and that goes along sometimes with a very visceral sense of blurring boundaries. And then the somewhat more surprising sense that maybe we don't think of as Buddhist and Zen would be a really sort of powerful sense of the universe really just sort of shooting up into every single existent thing, including oneself. And without going back over it, I'll call that a Chihuahua moment. And it's also within the tradition associated with Tathagata, you know, just the suchness of things really, really right there, and a sense of things having just stepped right out of emptiness and right out of nothingness to be where they are. So one of the things I tried to say last time is that variety of experience in some way is really encouraging, because I think sometimes we have an idea of what Zen experience is supposed to be, and we might say, oh no, what a terrible failure, myself has come back, and that really isn't where the story is. So you could be sitting in darkness, you could be feeling everything is streaming with light and everything is just like you were and everything is interpermeated, or you could have a feeling that you're like Quaker Oats shot from a gun in that 1950s commercial, that you're so full of exuberance. And all those things, I think, are completely part of the canonical story. So So that's one of the many ways in practice in which whatever's going on isn't wrong, and you don't need to wish you were somewhere else. So all that being true, there's an awful lot of humor within the tradition, sometimes really mordant, about, you know, regarding those moments as too special. So especially, I think it's a Soto attitude, but even in Rinzai, you're often told if there's stories about somebody going in and saying, oh, you know, everything has changed, and, you know, somebody's in the midst of this really strong kensho, and the teacher will say, just, oh, don't worry, it'll pass. You know, so as if that's fine, that's a good thing. And Suzuki Roshi, we remember, is asked if awakening is a complete remedy, and he says, oh no, but it's a pretty good remedy. And then there's that wonderful story about the 9th century teacher Zhao Zhou, when he has his first awakening, and the commentary says, again in this kind of bemused way, even though Zhao Zhou may be enlightened, he can truly get it only after studying for 30 more years. You know, so the tradition really throws you back into your regular life and asks you what you're going to make of whatever's happened to you in your Zen work so far. In our tradition, koan study is one way of getting thrown back into stuff, but there's certainly many ways. So what I wanted to do is to try and offer some kind of an experiential taking stock, just mostly from my own experience, which I don't think is too atypical, and also what I know from some other people anyway, about, you know, if something like that happens and then somebody says, oh, now 30 more years till you really get it, where are you, and what's a possible map of some things that have shifted maybe in a good way and some things that haven't shifted and may take 30 years to shift and so on. So the first thing, and I guess I've already said it, is that if you go into Zen practice with a kind of totalized sense that it's going to alleviate all the problems of being human because you won't have a self anymore, or it won't be the same kind of self it was in any respect, that's certainly not the story. And so, you know, as soon as you're in language and you're in consciousness and you're in thinking, which we all are most of the time, it probably is not so useful to say that there isn't a self. We're told sometimes in Buddhism that there's no self, but in that sense there's no tree either, and there's no rock, and there's no world, you know, that they're all a function of something else, but they're provisionally and temporarily real and useful categories. And so rather than any kind of purity that we think we might want, to go back to the koan that Jen brought in last time, what we get is something a lot more messy and multiple and complicated. I think it's useful to keep in mind that sense that we have from Joan, among other places, of the both and. So if you thought one thing was supposed to replace something else, that's probably not the way it's going to be. But it may be true that there's more stuff in the room, and so your old habits, your own sense of self, may in some very useful way be supplemented, maybe next to some other things that are now part of your experience. And because of that, the whole mix may shift or tip, at least a lot of the time, in important ways. So even if you're not still in the midst of them, the experiences that in some way, through meditation and practice, come from outside what we sometimes call the constructed self, are still in the room, and they're still real for you a lot of the time. So as Joan says, you become in some sense the guardian of the vow, as well as being the self. I think there are many other names for, you know, what that experience is, and just some of them we've talked about, which I won't go into, or maybe a storehouse consciousness, or the Alaya Vishnayana. But at any rate, one of the things that I think is important about the other stuff that gets into the room of the self or the room of the person is that a lot of it is non-narrative, that a lot of our meditation experience really takes us out of a sense of being inside a story, that we're held by something else that doesn't have that quality of beginning, middle, and end, and meaning, but just of a really large isness or something like that. And that having that in the room of the person that you are is a really crucial kind of supplement. And so to some extent, I think the self that you become is aware of those other things, is taking in information from those other things, memories from those other things. And that so the person in some sense, in Freud's terms, becomes a kind of compromise formation, that this is there, the other thing is there, and some mingling of those things really shapes our experience. You know? So I wanted to try and say a little bit more specifically about, from what I know, sort of what difference that difference makes and what difference it doesn't make. And so the first thing I want to say, there's a wonderful thing in a book by Peter Hirschhoff, where he says, it's not enough to know what Buddha nature is, you have to know what Buddha nature does. And Joan's really fond of quoting that. And so I want to focus sort of both on something that maybe not precisely, but the isness and the doesness, you know. So here's the isness aspect, and I think it's important, though it's for sure not the whole story. I remember hearing about therapy, about psychoanalytic therapy and other forms of therapy, reading someplace, somebody said, well, people will criticize it and say, well, so this guy's in therapy, been in therapy for a couple of years, and he doesn't seem that different to us, you know, so what's the point? And the person responded, well, yeah, but he probably seems a lot different to himself. The world probably seems a lot different to him, the world that he inhabits. And for sure, within the perspective of Buddhism, that's not enough. You have to know what Buddha nature does. But I think it's a really important difference, and it's a start. And I want to say just a little bit about that, you know. So I talked about this a little last time, but I think it's really true that the more experiences of the kind that we all have if we sit and if we have a practice of things opening up, things calming down, maybe descending into the darkness and coming back up again into light, there's a really deep sense in which one doesn't feel any more estranged from or exiled from one's own experience and the world. There's a real sense that you can reach out your hand or you can touch your heart, and that you're right at the origin when you do that. There's a kind of traditional thing people say, oh, if you have a big opening, then you would die happy that night. And I remember thinking, oh, that probably isn't exactly true, but it actually is kind of true, that something is really resolved and assuaged in a very, very deep way. I remember another time going back to a Koan retreat at Mountain Cloud, and just that we were on a break and just sitting at a table, you know, outside the back door, and just feeling just completely settled and at peace, and like nothing was wrong or could be wrong in some sense, in a way that I don't remember feeling before I started practicing. And I think those experiences really matter, and they're no guarantee of how we're going to treat other people on a day-to-day basis, but I think they've got a ripple effect and they really shift things in an important way. Another thing might be, this is maybe peculiar to me, but I remember after I've been practicing for a couple of years and things started seeming a lot more quiet and a lot more still, I'd be walking around the Saguaro Monument East or someplace like that, and everything else seemed to be just emanated from that still world, but a little bit impenetrable, you know. So it was like something's almost there. If I could just break through the surface of those things a little bit, then right inside them or right behind them is the sort of secret of that stillness that I can see in them, but I don't feel in myself. And then something shifted, and it was, you know, later, and it wasn't behind them at all. It was right on the surface. There wasn't anything not letting me in. And rather than being outside that stillness, you know, just feeling that I was inside it in a very important way and right where I needed to be, you know. And I'd associate that too with the Koan, where somebody says, you know, it's midnight, I walk through the town alone. Or John in the talk that we played in the Dharma group last time, saying, it's for you, you know, your life isn't for anybody else, it's for you. And my sense is that even if that's just what Buddha nature is in some way, that we have some experience of that and it's not enough, that it's a real gift, and the more people who experience that, the better the world is going to be, you know. So on the other hand, there's still the issue of the 30 years it's going to take to bring that out, and so you can, you know, make a real difference with people as much as you can. I was going to say something about what Norman said a couple days ago about absolute and relative bodhicitta, you know, but I think he did say he had us do an exercise at Antigone where we had to turn to each other and talk about ourselves and talk about our pets. And then afterwards he said, see, nobody complained about their pets. Everybody's like really wonderful. But he said, start talking about people and it gets different, you know. So relative bodhicitta, you know, certainly includes how we deal with other people. And for sure that's a 30-year project. So I wanted to say just a couple things, and I know I'm almost out of time, so I'll try to wind this up. But my sense of some things that to some extent shift, and as they shift, what's in the room feels different. You know, something gets a little stronger, something else doesn't have quite as much of a hold on us. And so that my sense is that this would be part of the sort of 30-year practice and some of the ways that things develop in it. So one thing would be a sense of buoyancy, that when things go wrong, when you fuck up, there's a lot less of a sense of a lot less of a tendency to sort of bog down in it forever. And there's a sense that there's something there that sort of floats you back up to try again. And I had some examples of that, including the conceptual poetry symposium that Barb remembers, where I kind of made an ass of myself, I thought, but, you know, was really excruciated, and in some way practice made no difference. But on the other hand, it was fine, you know, it didn't really matter. So there's that. Another thing would be, for sure, and I think we've all experienced a lot of this, would be at least some provisional skepticism about one's own models and the ability sometimes to kind of step out the story that outside of the story that we're telling, to have that fall away and to see what else is in front of us. And that seems like a really important shift. One version of that for me would be a lot less investment, though certainly not none, in whether I win the particular argument with somebody. It just kind of doesn't matter a lot of the time, and the rightness of the worldview that would be borne out by winning that argument seems really trivial. So I think sometimes, you know, we're sort of beyond particular blindnesses and errors of our own way of modeling the world, and sometimes in a big sense we sort of step outside them and see something larger and stiller. One version of something like that would be being a little more aware of our own ghost Buddhas. So Linji says that if you have some idea of what a Buddha is supposed to be, you hold that over against yourself, and that becomes a sort of sure sign that you're not a Buddha and that's not a Buddha. And I think with practice, there's more and more of a sense that you can locate those things, you can step back from them, and they don't have quite the hold over you that they once did. And along with that, maybe a sense that if you had been turned into a ghost Buddha by the process of seeing those ghost Buddhas, that you're not a ghost Buddha to yourself all the time. You're not unreal to yourself all the time. Another thing would be being more available to things. And I remember from our group with Jen, when we took the precepts, that we kind of decanted all of them into the master precept, I vow to be interruptible. And the ability to do that seems to be something that shifts a little bit more the more we practice. Another would be to have some trust that when we don't understand what's going on, that stuff is working in a subterranean way, and that we're not responsible for keeping tabs on all of it and herding it all into the right place so that we can let things work in the dark. Another one I remember, and this is also from the precepts group, is quite, it sounds like the Great Gatsby, but it's also Zen, is which, you know, you can't change the past. What do you mean you can't change the past? That as your experience shifts within practice, your sense of your own particular past and the particular hold it might have on you and what it means to you can also begin to shift and change in really important ways. And then underneath all of it, I think one of the things Joan likes to say is, you know, oh, so there you are combing a child's hair. And how do you comb the child's hair when you realize that the child's hair is made up of atoms that are billions of years old? You know, so we're always in that world of the vastness at every moment. And I think we have more ability to see that. And I think that changes, you know, not immediately and not absolutely, but changes how we deal with what's in front of us. Just say tell a little joke on myself and be done, you know. So I have Pat O'Hara, who some of us sat with for a long time in Santa Fe. The first time I was going to be head of practice, she said, oh, well, it's easy, you know, you have a lot of kids, so all you have to do is just remember to treat the people in the retreat like your kids, you know. And that made me a little uneasy, and I realized sort of about it. The practice thing for me was, what I have to learn to do is I have to treat my kids like I treat the people in retreat, you know. So it's always an unfinished task, but I think there's some buoyancy for giving it a try. And we're almost out of time, so I think I'll stop. Thank you.
We'll do our final vows, and those of you who I think need it have the little